and I was studying philosophy at the time, was really helpful to actually dismantle many ways of how we look at the world, into the world, and give meaning to things. So I was, at the one hand, missing philosophy in non-monogamy, and I was missing non-monogamy in philosophy.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're talking to Simone von Sarlos, author of Playing Monogamy. Written for more of a lay audience, the book proposes an expanded and polyamorous engagement with intimacy and sexuality as a possible alternative. It was originally written in Dutch and published by De Bezigabai Publication Studio. And I'm super impressed that I said that name right.
Me too.
Because it's not written like you would think. And is excited to bring this book to an English-speaking audience for the first time. So welcome, Simone. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So as I was reading this book, I read what the publisher said, that it was like written for more of a lay audience. But quite frankly, it's a very cerebral and very like intellectual book. You really have to sit with it and think about it and kind of like process everything that it says. And, you know, Jason, I and Dedeker, especially, like, we've been doing this for a while now, for many, many years, and yet it still proposed a lot of really interesting things that I didn't even think of before, like, on any non-monogamous journey that I've had. So from that standpoint, I was very impressed, and I just kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit, like, and Jace also wanted to ask, like, what your inspiration for writing the book was, and, like, why you decided to be so cerebral about it and bring this viewpoint to it.
You know, that's actually so great to hear that you experienced it like that. Thank you for that. Now I feel guilty about saying that it's more for a lay audience. I think that also comes from being sort of in between academic writing and writing for the public, yeah, as at least in the Netherlands it would be called, where writing for the public maybe also has immediately a kind of different audience, where there's such a large gap between academic writing and writing for the public. Especially because the Netherlands is such a small country, so Dutch is also a small language. So writing academically basically means having no audience at all.
Right.
And writing for public means having to reach out for everybody who speaks Dutch, almost.
Right.
That's at least how I experience it as a writer. And I think that in the US or North America, the gap is sort of smaller in a way, because even having an academic audience means that there's quite a large English-speaking audience that can still reach towards this academic language, right? Or has some familiarity of this academic language. So I think there's something there, even in, you know, like a cultural difference in terms of audience. But then in terms of, the inspiration for this book, obviously it came also from living non-monogamous myself. And I wrote this book in 2015. So I was 25 at the moment, and I did not see any, definitely not Dutch, but also not European based writing on non-monogamy. So all of the writing came from North America. And I couldn't find any in my own language or just in a European context. But then at the same time, everything I read from the US would always be sort of how to live polyamorous, how to live non-monogamous, and not so much use, at least how I felt, how I came to non-monogamy was not so much through living non-monogamous, because that sort of happened. But that didn't need to have a direct label. It was much more that I felt that non-monogamy, using this lens in philosophy, and I was studying philosophy at the time, was really helpful to actually dismantle many ways of how we look at the world, into the world, and give meaning to things. So I was, at the one hand, missing philosophy in non-monogamy, and I was missing non-monogamy in philosophy. Because, of course, you know, when you're studying philosophy, I mean, it's mostly white men that you're reading if you're in, you know, traditional academia. And so much of it is based on this hierarchizing or categorizing, getting to meaning through allowing yourself to say, like, oh, this is very important, or this is the red thread, or this is the important question that we're going to be asking. And I continuously felt like, oh, I do not understand and feel and effectively experience the world through that hierarchy.
Right.
And so in one way, yeah, it was really like pushing non-monogamy into philosophy, but also for me, philosophy and thinking are like feeling. So it's an embodied experience. So I need, in a way, I need this philosophy to be able to practice non-monogamy, because by thinking it through, it also starts existing for me. So it's not just like, oh, you know, how can I act polyamorous? I can find that online if I want to. And there has been also like great work written on it, right? I don't mean to demean any of the work that has been done. But without relating it to the way that we come to meaning and the way that we come to how we view the world, I cannot be non-monogamous, because then it just feels like living a set of rules. And also, actually, after, because this was my first book, Playing Monogamy was my first book. And I mean, I've written on a variety of topics after that. And I start to feel now that the translation has come out, which was 4 years after I've written the original version, that actually in all of my work, whether it is about the trial against Geert Wilders, who is a right-wing politician in the Netherlands, who was on trial for inciting hate, or whether it's about memory and commemoration, all of this thinking from a non-monogamous perspective is still there, or actually just develops more and more.
Right, it still affects the way that you approach all of it.
Yeah.
There's still this non-monogamous lens and this sort of non-hierarchical attempt, at least, to think, right? Because I think that's also what I find so beautiful in all of the writing that is about non-monogamy and all the conversation about non-monogamy, that it is about an attempt. And it's also an attempt in which you acknowledge and realize that we have been conditioned in certain ways, but we can try differently. So there's also this sort of utopic, utopian sphere in non-monogamy, I feel at least, that I actually want to honor. Instead of saying like, oh, no, it's just a practicality. You can't do it. It's easy. People are doing it anyway already. You know, which is great to have these examples, but constantly pushing for something more and to imagine a world otherwise.
Yeah.
In which indeed love does exist, but in different ways.
That's kind of a good segue into my next question, which you talk about this internalized disbelief that a different relationship rationality is possible. But recently, I guess within, I'd say, the last 4 years since you've written the book, there has been more of a rise of alternative lifestyles, people talking about it, people speaking about it in media. So do you think that this internalized disbelief has become less ingrained since you wrote the book in 2015? And if not, I mean, what are some of the ways in which we can start to let go of that internalized thought?
Yeah, let me try and separate that question in two, I guess, because it's interesting you said the word lifestyle, right? And I think indeed, as a lifestyle, non-monogamy has become more and more accepted, or it has been at least more prevalent. I mean, New York Times, I mean, accepted, maybe not the right word, but definitely more prevalent, more known. It's something you can refer to, and then people can, you know, like there's some articles out there that are easy to divert people to. You know, if you would be at your standard sort of traditional nuclear family birthday party and some faraway uncle asks, so how is it? Why are you talking about this person? And last time you're talking about that person, Did you break up? No, I'm actually together with them both. And they're like, oh, polyamory. You know, like there might be this sort of sigh of relief, like I've heard about this. Mm. But I would be critical of the idea that indeed then it becomes more accepted, or that non-monogamy as a sort of tool to live this different kind of life actually comes true, because that's why I'm pressing this word lifestyle. I wonder whether it's not, I think too often it is seen as a lifestyle. Yeah. So as some sort of identity you can stick on or off. Mm. It is also often even seen as, you know, a choice, where I do think there's an element of choice in how you live your life. I choose to think more about non-monogamy from a cultural point of view. So like, how is monogamy invested in our culture? How did it come about? And what would non-monogamy do to our culture? So instead of making non-monogamy or polyamory, and maybe I should explain later why I divert these terms, but the way that non-monogamy is made safe, actually, you know, to make it an accepted lifestyle. So non-monogamy is made safe by saying like, oh, well, you know, it's something you don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. It's my choice, maybe. And I came to the conclusion it works better for me. And I think that even though I do not want to pressure anybody in non-monogamy or monogamy or any other kind of lifestyle, quote unquote, I do try to see non-monogamy as a tool to push against a cultural hegemony, mm-hmm. where it's not just about like, oh, what fits you well? Because then indeed it's like, oh, well, are you choosing yoga, sure. or going to the gym and lifting weights? And I think I'm pushing this sort of, this component of lifestyle, because I do think that there is an easy commodification in that, right? Like there's a commodified lifestyle, and where non-monogamy is sort of acceptable as long as you carry it out in a certain way, or maybe you even have to be proud, and maybe it has to be a hashtag as well. And I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And
you know, and then I think non-monogamy should be a bit dangerous, by which I do not mean that people who are living non-monogamous are dangerous or dirty people in any way, you know, which is, of course, also a stigma that people are fighting against. So I do not want to take away the hardships of people who are fighting those stigmas in their daily lives, and who do have to, you know, go for the narrative of coming out because they might be in the closet, and I'm using quote marks here as well, in the closet at work as a polyamorous triangle or something like that. So I do not want to negate that in any way. But for me, I hope that non-monogamy is dangerous. And with dangerous, I mean that it's also, it dismantles the way we think about relationships and basically anything in our life from the point of view of property, mm-hmm. From the point of view of commodity, of does it work well for you? In which, when you say that, does it work well for you? There's a you, right? That's centralized, or there's an I that's centralized, where it's like, oh, something either works for you or it doesn't. But should we also not talk about the way that subjectivity is constructed? Where the way that you consider yourself in relationship to others is very much related to this sort of I, or how you view yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it also reminds me a little bit of a debate that I've heard going around before too, about the question of, you know, is polyamory queer? And one of the things that I thought was really interesting in that discussion is that it's sort of, it can be, but it also cannot be. And the definition of queer that was given at that time is that part of queerness is kind of dismantling this status quo, this kind of commodification and things like that, that basically, you know, you could be polyamorous and kind of, like you said, maybe the polyamorous lifestyle in quotes, but in that very New York Times friendly, still very commodified, still very defined and
it's
prescribed.
It's like palatable, yeah,
right.
For people, exactly.
And so in that way, you could be polyamorous and not be queer at all, or you could be polyamorous but be queer in the way that you're going about it in terms of kind of like what it sounds like you're talking about, where it's the whole kind of philosophy behind it of trying to get to the bottom of these kind of... we've been trained into these hierarchies or these ways of possessiveness of other people and things like that, and kind of questioning that and trying to tear that apart, which is something that on this show, we try to talk about that also in terms of whether you are choosing a monogamous lifestyle or not, to maybe use the quotes the other way around, right? That you could embody that kind of, you know, polyamorous philosophy, like the stuff that you talk about in your book, but still be
Absolutely.
Choosing to live a monogamous relationship while still thinking in that different way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, I mean, if you want to be harsh, then there's this question of why would you then conclude to be monogamous? Because if you're dismantling all these ideas, then suddenly monogamy maybe doesn't allow for safety so much, because often monogamy seems to be chosen for this reason of safety, you know, like I want to be safe. But then also, what does it mean? What does safety mean? I mean, it's an individual question, but it's also a societal question. And I know you talked about this on your show as well, right? Like couple privilege, for example, right. And the safety that people get through being in a couple or through appearing monogamous. And I think for me, this is also one of the reasons why I prefer to use the word non-monogamous or non-monogamy over polyamory, because if you look into the history of polyamory, it's a very short sort of and mostly white and middle class history, mostly centered in North America. And it kind of excludes many moments and many lives that were lived non-monogamous, but aren't necessarily labeled or categorized as non-monogamous and definitely not as polyamorous. And one of the things that I'm thinking about is, for example, in Saidiya Hartman's book, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, she writes about Black women in North America around the 1900s and these wayward lives, right? So there's women who have queer intimacies, interracial intimacies, intergenerational intimacies, but most of them are non-monogamous intimacies. But instead of being called polyamorous, for example, they are viewed as sex workers and they're criminalized as sex workers, as Black women. And then you see that this idea of monogamy is very much related to safety, not just on this individual choice level where like, oh, I feel safer in a monogamous relationship, but also in terms on a societal level, you are literally more safe when you are in a monogamous relationship. Because one way that and this is, of course, you know, written about the 1900s, but one way to be safe back then for Black women was to get married.
Right.
And so I think and another thing I'm thinking about, for example, is Gloria Wecker's book, The Politics of Passion, which is maybe also a little less known in the non-monogamous region. But she writes about Afro-Surinamese women. Suriname was a former colony of the Netherlands. So this is a close history to the Netherlands, but where women would live together in what we would consider, I think, non-monogamous constellations, have relationship with each other, have relationships also with men, which I guess we would call bi, right? But then having a very different language for this and never saying, for example, I am lesbian, but saying I do the mutty work. So doing also instead of being And this doing is related, for example, to the spiritual religion of Vinti, which is the name for wind, where you would think that a certain spirit comes to visit you at a certain time, and that spirit might like to lie down with women. Mm-hmm. So that would make you desire at that moment women, but the spirit can also go. So having a lot less of this sort of, the sort of identitarian way of experiencing your sexuality and your behavior. But also then, I mean, I'm sorry if I'm like taking it off, but that too leads to this idea of safety, right? Like, mm-hmm. because if you labor yourself, you're safe. So depending, of course, where you live, but it's kind of, I mean, at least in the Netherlands, it's safe somehow to be gay, but you do have to say you're gay, right? You do have to be sort of, you do have to carry that label, because if you carry that label, they can categorize you. And I'm saying date, it sounds a bit too big, brother. But there are, of course, you know, like whether it's data through Facebook or whether it's government data, mm-hmm. There are, of course, a lot of profits being made of the categorization of our identities, right?
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, and that was also, I remember growing up, you know, growing up during the 90s, particularly when I feel like the conversation about gay rights, basically, before we're even getting to marriage, but just about sort of discrimination and things like that, when I feel like that conversation was really kind of hitting the media a lot, that the question that it felt like to me was sort of central to that was this question of, do you have a choice? Like, are you just born this way and that you're born that way? And so if that's true, like kind of the logic goes, right, if you're born gay and there's nothing you can do about it, then it means, well, either God made you that way or biology made you that way. And so therefore it's okay. It's okay mm-hmm. as long as you didn't mm-hmm. get to choose and you just are this thing, kind of that identity, like you said, rather than just... Mm-hmm. Oh, I do gay sometimes. That's like, oh, well, if that's what you're doing, then we can condemn it and we can say, mm-hmm. no, you should make better choices or that's somehow wrong. And so in that way, like arguing for that being an identity, that being a rigid thing, was maybe strategically the move to make it be acceptable, to then be able to defend it and not get fired for it and things like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's kind of, it just furthers that identification, that being rigid, like you have to fit this label or you don't.
Yeah, need for normalcy.
Mm. Right.
Within our society. Interesting.
Mm. Yeah, and it is also meant to uphold a mainstream being, right? Like it's this idea of, oh, 10% of the population is gay or queer or LGBTQIA, right? But then like this percentage, why do we need it? Okay, mm-hmm. we need it to upkeep the 90% that are then considered the normal. And this is maybe when I'm saying like, oh, I want non-monogamy to be a bit dangerous, is that I also kind of, when I think about, you know, like the New York Times way of presenting polyamory, it is indeed so much made to be about a lifestyle that there's not, you know, there's not this sort of warning of like, be careful, non-monogamy is contagious.
Right.
And I think there should be sort of, you know, like this sort of warning. And I mean this in a joyful and playful way, but I think there should be a warning because, well, maybe it's like revolution is contagious in the sense that,
yeah,
when it is not about this, indeed, like you're saying, right? Like it becomes about this identity and it's something that can be contained, but it becomes about having a critical lens towards also, for example, I mean, I know that you talked about the relationship escalator on your show, mm-hmm. right? This idea of going through a certain linear timeline where the only end of the escalator is, you know, death. Either breaking up and then it all failed yeah. or death, right? Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, you don't have to, like you were saying, you can still choose whatever that then means, but to live monogamous or to not have sex at all. And then how are you going to categorize yourself, right? Like this is also, can you be asexual and polyamorous? Yeah, you can, but so you get this constant shifting. But speaking about this relationship escalator, this idea of moving through time. And developing through different stages. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that we don't only see in monogamy or in relationships. It's something that we see in every aspect of our lives. When we look at currently the abortion bans in the southern states of the US, people will say it's medieval or we're going back in time. But we're not actually going back in time. We're not going down the escalator or down the stairs. We're still in the same time. But there's this idea of like, oh, if you do not like something, or if you think something is backward, or something doesn't belong to your reality, then it is something that is in the past. So it's backward. It's medieval laws, or it's this idea of you can separate yourself through being in the future versus being in the past.
Right. Like this idea that progress is like a linear thing through time.
Well, and you talked about that with relationships as well, that like we always, as a society, tend to be like, well, I'm glad that I went through that relationship, even though it failed, because it made me into the person that I am today, or it made me stronger. And I thought that was really interesting because, again, yeah, it's like, well, I'm leveling up a little bit in relationships somehow by going through this challenge that I no longer am having anymore or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that we as a society just always want to like get to the next thing, level up, be better, whatever, when it doesn't really work like that. That's kind of, again, a construct in our mind, I guess.
Yeah, and it, I mean, it even relates to Dan Savage's idea of it gets better, right? And on the one hand, you want teenagers who are desperate to know that there is community out there. And there is, you know, but to say it gets better also sort of goes into this idea of like, yeah, there are, everything needs to be linear and have progress, progress in it. Where maybe it doesn't necessarily get better, right? And for who does it get better?
Interesting. I wanted to question, okay, you talked about how potentially your book, Playing Monogamy, could be interpreted as a plea for greedy individualism. So I found this to be really interesting because I do think that Western society tends to prize individualism more than like tribal cultures or really family-based societies. But so can you speak to this a little bit? Like why so many people do feel guilty when they put themselves and their desires first? Because I agree with you that like, even if we are a society that cares about the individual, we still also really care about the nuclear family and things along those lines. So can you speak about this a little bit here? Because I found that to be really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's different things at play there. I mean, for one, I think there's an actual agenda behind making people feel like they're individualistic when they turn themselves against a nuclear family, right? Because that we need to be told in order to keep up the idea of the nuclear family being a sort of natural responsibility, something that helps us go outside of individualism. I would personally say that the nuclear family and individualism go perfectly together. Because indeed, like you're saying, if we're imagining societies, whether it be our own society that changed throughout time, or whether we attempt to look at other societies without wanting to utter them, right? But there must be many ways of living outside of the protected nuclear family, where we say that the nuclear family is a way to keep ourselves safe. So then you see that the nuclear family is instrumentalized to keep your own sort of sort or well, I wouldn't say species, but your own people safe, which of course completely conflicts with the actuality of what happens in families, in terms of abuse or violence. So there's a weird tying nuclear family to safety. However, what worries me more maybe, and this is where I'm like, oof, I hope it, I know that I'm also guilty of pleading for a greedy individualism because I cannot escape this conditioning. But the reason that I say that, or what I'm mostly scared of, is that I, like we were talking just now about safety so much. And by pleading for a different way of looking at how to be safe or how to take risks outside of that, which outside of the usual patterns, it easily can look like you need to be a very strong individual in order to do that, or you need to be a very conscious individual in order to do that. And I think non-monogamy or polyamory as a tradition has a bit of a problem there, because it's very language-based, and there's often a lot of pressure on communication, right? Wanting to be non-monogamous, there's this idea of you need to be able to communicate well, and you need to be able to be willing to communicate. And though I agree with that, there is also a difficulty in that, because it also privileges language as a way of being, as an ability, where you could wonder whether there would be other ways of communicating with each other that wouldn't just be through language and differentiating and being nuanced in language. So I think that's one danger there. And yeah, I also think that I'm very wary of it, because it is easier to play, to plead or to argue for stepping outside of safety when you are, in my case, privileged in many different ways, and where unsafety is not the basis of my existence. To give the easiest example, I've never experienced poverty. So me pleading for a certain level of unsafety, it might not be the right way. However, saying that the way that we are taught safety can be reached might be a better way, because by saying that, you might also attach yourself in two ways of being that are in itself already precarious because of the inequalities in our society. What do I mean by that? It's just, I think it's very difficult from my standpoint. Also, somebody who lives in the Netherlands has healthcare, for example, and say, "Oh, unsafety." That it's not the right, you know, I'm not the right person to continue pleading for that. On the other hand, I also think that by avoiding precarity, we're also avoiding lives that are currently ingrained and embedded and fundamentally build on precarity just by the way that society has created inequalities.
Yeah.
If this makes sense.
I mean, it's something that I've wondered about sometimes, because what you're saying is so true, that like, especially with something like polyamory, where most of the people talking about it are privileged, right? You know, even if they're not all white men, they're still types of privilege, right? Whether it's economic or just the country that they live in, or education, or, you know, there's lots of things there. And on the one hand, it's on the one hand, I can see an argument for, yes, but because those people are, like you said, not living constantly with, you know, unsafety being sort of a defining factor in their lives, that those are the people who it shouldn't be as safe for. That maybe those are the people who need to be living it in a way that is a little less safe because they can afford to do that, rather than keeping that something that the people who already are struggling with that more, with being more disenfranchised or being more even physically at risk, rather than kind of leaving it to them to still be living unsafely, that perhaps people who are privileged giving up some of their safety to be changing the way that people think and to be the ones that people can look at and, you know, to be the ones people can engage with to try to change the way that everyone treats people. And hopefully through that, making the world a little bit more safe for the less safe, if that makes sense. I don't know if I kind of lost the thread of my philosophy there.
No, but I think what I would add to that, though, that it is a structure of amplification, like who gets to speak. Returning to this idea of, you know, polyamory versus non-monogamy and choosing, in this case, non-monogamy, because the term opens up towards histories and current lives that are otherwise not seen as polyamorous. And I think there's many lives being lived currently that we wouldn't say are monogamous, or we wouldn't categorize them as not as monogamous, but that are in the mainstream discourse then seen as failed, flawed, unhealthy, but that they're not amplified as sort of, you know, like this. Oh, but no, but I choose to be non-monogamous, or, and I can even explain you why and excise it. So I think that is also, I mean, this is something this is often acknowledged, right? Like this idea of like, oh, in order to be openly poly, you have to be healthy and happy. You have to sort of be presentable in your non-monogamy.
Yeah.
And I think that is definitely a pressure that most non-monogamous people go through. But I think there's also not just a way of how non-monogamous people have to present themselves, but also how non-monogamous people and monogamous or whatever people have to train their ear towards lives that are already living otherwise, but that we do not categorize and see, and that we do not think valuable of a New York Times piece. Sorry to continue using that, because we do not view it as a lifestyle. Because it doesn't start from indeed this sort of 100% privilege and then diverting. No, it's diverting without ever having adapted to the sort of societal norm of what a healthy lifestyle is. And I think it is then we often see that this becomes actual marginalized lives. We still expect people, I'm saying we, I don't know who this we is, but society still expects people that they want to get married if they do not seem to have access to that. I mean, one of the examples in the US is, of course, Katie Cohen's work on Black love, Black families, having a Marry Your Black Daddy Day or something like that, as she calls it. I'm sorry if I'm phrasing it wrong, but there's these pushes towards marriage and this idea also that not being married is sort of telling or a signifier of failure.
Right.
Where actually this is also a form of non-monogamous living that is not being recognized as such, because there's still this expectation of a certain norm that, you know, if only people weren't so poor, they would also get married. Or they would also choose long-term partnerships or one partner for raising their kids.
Yeah, there is a lot of assumption based in that, in the social worth of it. And I think that's really interesting to make that, to relate that to how we look at poverty, at income, that it's like, if only they had the money, then they would be married, or then they would be monogamous, or then they would only have kids with one other person instead of several, or, you know, whatever it is that we do It was just
assumptions. Yeah,
I was just hearing a conversation earlier today that was saying almost exactly that, of the kind of equating poverty with having multiple baby daddies was kind of the context of it, and that's very true. That there is that link of like, oh yeah, it's just linear.
Assumption,
you know, if you had more money, you would also be a better contributing member of society, which means being monogamous, which means only, you know, only having kids with one other person, which means getting married, which means, you know, whatever, owning a house, whatever the signifiers are. I feel like sometimes they change a little, but they do tend to be based around these either like accomplishments or possessions. And I guess with some of them, you could even look at them as the same thing. Okay, sorry. All right. I want to move on to our next question here.
There's so much to say and to theorize on. Yeah, it's amazing.
We keep getting distracted with philosophy.
That's fine, though.
It's great.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love adamandeve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
Okay, so So this next one, so many passages in your book, it reads like poetry, I think. Yeah. You know, it's got that sort of philosophical, poetic sort of way of writing. And at one point you talked about how love and death are both industries based around the dollar, based around making money. And rather than just read a bunch of quotes to the audience, I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate on this. And then maybe if we could also get into not only pointing out how that's true, but what are some ways that we could live outside of that? What are ways we could conduct a relationship that isn't based around money being spent or being earned by it?
It starts sort of, for me, it starts with this idea of love is love, right? Because when same-sex marriage was legalized in the US, obviously love is love went viral and it's still a well-used hashtag. And I started to wonder, well, what does this mean? Because as a philosopher, this is, you know, this sentence, love is love, is like, well, what does this say?
What are we meant by this, actually?
Three words with two words. Yeah. Not so poetic. And so it's this question of like, what do we mean when we say love? Okay, we mean monogamy. It's like monogamy and love are sort of synonym in that too, because it's so surrounded about having same-sex marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this question of signifiers. What signifies a love relationship? How do we recognize a love relationship? And this is almost, for me, this is almost language philosophy, right? Like it's, okay, we see two people walking hand in hand. This must mean that they have a romantic love relationship. I must sort of interject here that my lover is, one of my lovers is a lot older than I am. So when we walk hand in hand, people often assume she's my mother. So I guess that also happens. But there is this assumption, right? Oh, we just want to walk hand in hand. And you even hear this in gay couples often saying like, oh, I just want to be able to walk hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Now, I do not want to negate anybody's freedom or anybody's choice, wish, desire to walk hand in hand. This should, of course, never be responded to with violence. But to claim this as the sort of ultimate freedom and to say like, this is what I want because I love somebody and thus I want to walk hand in hand, kind of takes away that actually walking hand in hand is also a signifier. So it's also something that was constructed as meaningful and as a form and a gesture of love. There's not any natural sort of, there's not a natural cause for wanting to walk hand in hand as a sort of expression of love. There could be many, many other ways. When you talked about death, I mean, one of the things that I see so significant, or one image that I find so significant, is, for example, when I was living in New York, and there's the site in Brooklyn, Dumbo, where you can see the waterside, you can sit at the waterside, and you can see the skyline of New York, right, of Manhattan. And people get their picture taken. Mm-hmm. And it's this moment where if you sit there for a while, you will see many different couples. But even though there are many different couples, they're all couples. So they're all, always one and one. Mm-hmm. They're often straight, but not always. And when the woman is pregnant, there's these four hands on the belly, right? Like, so there's this whole choreography of what this picture looks like. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking about indeed death and grief and mourning rituals, where I'm like, oh, you know, like getting your picture taken as a couple looks very much like being at a funeral home, that at least in my experience, being in a funeral home usually means that after a while you start seeing another family coming in that also has booked the funeral home. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of acknowledgement of like, oh yeah, okay, in mourning rituals, we need sometimes, or in grief, we need rituals in order to feel. It's not always that you can access your sad feelings. You cannot always access your grief, but we have those rituals developed, whether they work or not, that help us feel. So sometimes you place the ritual first, and then the feeling comes through that. We know that rituals of mourning help us feel. When it comes to love, however, there's such a different causality, because it's sort of like, well, I really love this person, therefore, I want to be monogamous. Therefore, I want to get my picture taken in front of the skyline of Manhattan. And I'm ridiculizing it a little bit, of course, but I think there is a truth to that, to say like, oh, but I really love this person and just thus I want this, instead of saying like, well, I've seen other people taking their pictures as a couple together. And I think that if I do that as well, I will feel good about my love. I will sort of strengthen and establish my love feeling. So saying that the ritual in this sense shapes the feeling of love, instead of saying and always claiming that love goes in before this sort of ritual.
Can I just, something that struck me while you were talking about that is something that I remember for the first time, maybe 10 years ago, really kind of getting presented with the importance of ritual and how, you know, how important that can be, kind of like you're talking about, like the rituals we have around grieving help us to feel or to process things. And what's striking me right now about what you're talking about is this question of, I guess, the difference between a ritual, which is sort of to serve a purpose either for an individual or for a community or for a group that's still kind of an internal purpose, versus what I think maybe you're talking about with the pictures is like a performance, and like a performance versus a ritual. That's an interesting question there, because it's making me think about, for example, in Japan, I spend a fair amount of time in Japan with Dedeker, and we went to this Buddhist temple that's, this particular one is specifically devoted to dead children, to put it bluntly, whether that's abortions or miscarriages or infants who've died. And what I learned through this is that there is kind of a whole tradition around that, a whole ceremony that, say, if you've gotten an abortion, there's a ceremony to kind of, you know, offer up a like a little statue and sort of to pray to the spirit of that child and to, you know, kind of have some processing around that. And then I learned that there's been some research that the instances or the duration of depression after an abortion, when doing that kind of ritual, it does mitigate that. Like, it makes that amount of like isolation and depression a lot less because there's a way to process it, as opposed to being something you just have to hide and kind of think about on your own. So in that way, like, I think that ritual is so important. And yet, like you're pointing out, on the other hand, we can sometimes take something that could be a ritual and when we put it on social media, it now becomes a performance. And it's less about...
Well, and like even religion can be one of those two things as well. It can be both ritual and just a performative way of doing things.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's interesting. It is still like this construct in our mind that like, well, I'm doing this thing and I believe that it will help me and move me, you know, onto the next thing or whatever, or make me better in some way, which is interesting. And I don't know, the performance aspect of being in a relationship. Yeah, I guess it's like, who is that for? Is that for yourself? Is that for society? Is that for the other person? I don't know. But that's very interesting. It struck me so much when I read that part, because I'm like, damn, wow, that is so true. And I don't know how to do... It's like, how do you even do things other than that? I have no idea.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I think, I mean, indeed, I would like to say that I have nothing against performance or ritual. Not even nothing against. I think it's actually how we create life, right? So if you're asking like how to be outside of that, I think actually through playing, through creating other performances than the performances that are naturalized as love. So I don't think there's something wrong about having a performance in order to evoke feeling. I just wish it wouldn't collapse, right? Like, I wish the performance of love or couplehood wouldn't collapse with saying that this is just how you feel love, with saying that this is because I feel love, I need to get our picture taken. Because I feel love, I of course want to show it on Instagram. And I'm not saying that there's necessarily something wrong with that. I just wish that the causality would be a bit more stretched and be like, well, if I think that I feel something, why wouldn't I express it in another way? And I think that would be one way to go out of it, right? Like, that would be one way to try... What would happen if I perform differently towards this one person, or two people, or four? But if you just imagine a dating session, a dating night, right? Like, I'm just making this up right now, but where you're sort of, you know, there's this expectation of going through a certain set of questions, or at one point showing somebody that you like somebody, but then. Or not. But then what if you would allow yourself to have the same sort of feeling? What if you had already felt that you kind of like this person, or you would kind of like to continue this night, but you would perform completely differently, completely different than you would be expected to? Could you still feel that you like that person, or would you feel completely otherwise?
Like, which is the cause and which is the effect, kind
exactly.
of?
Exactly. God. I mean, we do talk about, like, being really mindful about our relationships and choosing, you know, what does work best for us, I guess, and speaking about those things. But it is so interesting to see, like, even down to the, like, minutia of it all, down to, like, I'm performing essentially the same type of thing on a date. You know, we talk, we have a drink, we have a little, you know, flirtation, get more into the intense conversation than, are we going to get a kiss at night? Are we going to call each other again? Like, it does follow this this linear kind of fashion of what, you know, basically what our lives look like down to the smallest detail. That's so interesting. And that is something that I don't think, it sounds like to me, you are asking just people to disrupt that in a way, or to at least think about it, to at least go, you know, question like, why am I doing this? If I did it in a different way, can it be just as meaningful and just as profound?
Yeah, and I think indeed, I mean, maybe this goes back again to this idea of safety, right? Like, what if it doesn't need to feel good? And I don't mean, this is a very difficult question, you know, because you immediately, it's like, oh, are you saying you shouldn't have consent or something? I don't mean that. But I mean that in terms of our bodies, it's not just our thought, it's our bodies, which is our thought, which, you know, and vice versa, are conditioned to feel good at certain moments, not just because we feel good, but because we feel we're not disrupting something that is, you know, a body muscle almost. So it's not just like, you probably are able to think outside of this fashion of saying like, oh, you know, we're slip a kiss, maybe call. You can think yourself outside of that, but how does it feel to even to act outside of that? And to not say that if I act outside of that, this is immediately my identity. But to say, if I act outside of that, because we have consensually sort of come to a disagreement of like, let's play together instead in this sort of like, let's try something. Let's try a different performance. Let's try a different ritual. And that's something that when you said, when you talked about this ritual that you witnessed, this ceremony, I was completely with you till you said that research showed that it helps people in their healing. Because I was like, well, what if we can trust ourselves enough that we do not need research in order to understand the need for ceremony, for ritual, for play, for performance? That we do not need to have this sort of rationalized or legible making research that says that our feelings exist in a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that is the risk. That is the largest risk. It's sort of like how to live without having this measurement that tells you, yes, indeed, what you're feeling and doing is true.
That's interesting, because I feel like, and something that I think you talked about earlier, about this idea of, you know, making effort to be not hierarchical in the way that you think about philosophy and things like that, with the acknowledgement that I put effort into it because I know that it's been so ingrained in me, and that that's so in me that if I just try to pretend, oh, I'm not going to be hierarchical, I am. And that kind of having that awareness of, you know, to use a metaphor, like the awareness of the water that you're swimming in allows you to then take actions to get to a place that is more, I guess, more neutral or more unaffected, ironically, by affecting yourself, by intentionally steering yourself away from it. And so I feel like, for my experience at least, the importance of research and things like that, rather than just, quote, trusting ourselves, is that sometimes we're not the best at perceiving ourselves. And so having something outside to give us a vantage point can help to then do those sorts of corrections.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's...
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, we're starting to come up a little bit on time. It's funny because we're going to talk more in the bonus episode, and I initially had an idea of what I wanted to talk about in that, but now I'm like, we should just continue these conversations because they're so fantastic.
Maybe we can do both.
Yeah, exactly. I did want to ask where everyone can find more of your work and what is next on the horizon for you.
Ooh, yeah.
If we can even find it in English.
Yeah. No, that's one of the things. So, I mean, funnily enough, talking about ceremony, my last book just came out a few weeks ago, the Dutch one, on memory and commemoration. And it's talking about the way that memory can weigh us down, even out of action. So like how to take action, maybe through forgetting. But then it also goes into, well, you know, you can say forgetting, but that totally depends on whether your history is documented or not. So I talk about white remembering, right. Talk about white erasure, and then I go into embodied and daily commemoration. So then we get the body in again, right? Like this, what are the practices we could think of that would help us commemorate? So you mentioned ceremonies. That is one way. There's so many different ways of embodied commemoration, but it would be less about having sort of monuments, having written history, all of these kind of things. But this is all in Dutch.
So for our Dutch speaking audience, they can check that out. But what can our English speaking listeners find for you?
Playing Monogamy.
This which book,
I,
clearly.
Yeah, which people absolutely should read because I think it blew my mind in a way also that this conversation kind of blew my mind, but it definitely makes it's just so powerful. It's a easy, you know, it's a quick read, but it's, you really do need to sit with it because there's a lot to digest and unpack within it, in my opinion.
Right. It's great, short, but you need to spend some time sitting with each section to get it.
Can people find it on Amazon or on various, where is the best way in which to get the book?
Through Publication Studio.
Okay.
And Publication Studio is a worldwide network of publishers. So depending on where you are, you can get it through the nearest by publisher.
Okay.
Publication
great.
Studio. Yeah.
Okay. We'll try to add a link or do something in the show notes for sure.
Thanks.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And then, we're going to stick around and do a little bonus episode for our patrons where we're going to talk more about this, maybe get into your social wheel of five, but I also am really interested in talking about hierarchy with you some more because we touched on it, but that's something that our listeners are interested in for sure. So I do want to discuss that.
So thank you so much for joining us, Simone. To everyone listening at
home,
we would love to hear what you think about this. Was there anything that was mind-blowing for you? And you'll be like Emily did when she was reading this book. She kept texting quotes to Dedeker and me.
Yeah.
Being like, oh my gosh, you guys. Maybe that was your experience. Or maybe there's something you feel like we totally missed that you wished we'd gone into. The best place that you can share your thoughts with other listeners is on this episode's discussion thread in our private Facebook group or Discord chat. You can get access to these groups and join our community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can email us at info@multiamory.com, leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05, or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. Multiamory is created and produced by Emily Matlack, Dedeker Winston, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our production assistants are Rachel Schenowork and Carson Collins. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.
So, you've got an idea for a business. The store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.